From WBUR Boston, this is Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Deborah Becker. Each week, we bring you the best of Boston University from the worlds of scholarship, letters, politics, and the arts. Tonight, we present the first of three installments from the annual lecture series, The Fascination with Jewish Tales, by teacher, author, and Nobel Peace Prize winner, Elie Wiesel. Tonight's lecture is titled, In the Bible, The Akedah Revisited, More Questions. We begin with an introduction by Boston University professor Abigail Gilman from the Department of Modern Languages and Comparative Literature in the College of Arts and Sciences. Professor Gilman.
It is my privilege to welcome you all to the 32nd annual University Lecture Series devoted to the fascination with Jewish tales at Boston University. Elie Wiesel is known throughout the world as a writer, scholar, and activist for human rights. Here at Boston University, he is a teacher, first and foremost. He is the Andrew W. Mellon Professor in the Humanities, a position he has held since 1978. He is also university professor and professor of philosophy and religion. Professor Wiesel's point of departure is the world of Eastern European Jewry, a world whose destruction he personally experienced. From that point, he has gone on to speak and write on the entire range of Jewish experience, and he is the author of 47 books. This evening, we will travel with Professor Wiesel into the depths of the Hebrew Bible, into Genesis chapter 22. He has lectured on the Akedah twice before and also written about it in the widely read essay, The Sacrifice of Isaac, A Survivor's Story, that appears in his 1976 book, Messengers of God. Professor Wiesel.
So, let us return to the Akedah, the binding of Isaac. It is a tale about anguish and faith that has never left us. Actually, it never let us go. The event that happened on Mount Moriah 4,000 years ago continues to haunt our memory and our lives like a stinging wound. It's impossible to detach ourselves from it. It is with fear and trembling that Søren Kierkegaard approached the subject, and is the same for us. The more I explore it, and I do so often, the less I come closer to a resolution. The more I dive into it, the more I find myself lost, as if in a thick black forest from which no way out leads to a single and maybe reassuring truth. All the questions I have asked myself more than 30 or odd years ago here remain open and burning. Was the history of the Jewish people thus going to begin in a way that violates what is most frail, most human in the human being, with an attempted murder? I still do not understand why Abraham needed a tenth test to prove the strength and solidity of his faith in one God. Nor do I understand why God needed this test. And really, did Abraham already have his free will? Was he able to freely decide what to say to his Creator? At the beginning of my search, years and years earlier, I had suggested that it was perhaps a double test. In the same way that God was testing Abraham, Abraham was testing God, as if he were to say to himself, okay, let's see if God truly and sincerely insists on this inhuman sacrifice. He who has already prepared the Torah, the law, forbidding murder and child sacrifice, will he really want to abrogate that law? But then, is it also possible that the test has a completely other meaning, or more than one, more than many? Is it possible that God actually wanted, even hoped, that Abraham would refuse? And so Abraham and God would have won both the same bet. But let's not get ahead of ourselves. Are we sure that Abraham knew it was a test? Was he really thinking right from the start that this was indeed divine will to see how a father becomes his son's murderer? How could the creator of the universe and the father of its creatures demand such an act from the one person who first crowned him alone God and all-powerful? And how could this same one, known for his extraordinary compassion towards others, those unknown and even guilty and wicked, submit himself to such a command? The man who was able to hold his own against the creator and the judge of the universe while defending the wicked Sodom, why did he give in when it came to his own flesh and blood? In my research, I discovered that the Akedah, a term which only appears in this chapter of the Bible and nowhere else, preoccupies our most important sages of the Talmud, our illustrious Tosafists and mystics of the Middle Ages, as much as their successors and students throughout the ages, Maimonides and Nachmanides, Ibn Ezra and Levi ben Gershon, the famous Ralbag, Rabbi David Kimchi, the Radak, and naturally the uniquely marvelous scholar who some of you may have known, Shalom Spiegel, among so many others. Pulling my hypothesis from theirs, taking into account their analysis as well as their philosophical and poetic insights, I proposed explanations here and there which I believed to be original, more out of naivete than pride, but these had already been covered extensively in Midrashic texts. And when I discovered that, I felt proud rather than embarrassed. With the years, I can only admit that there is still, and perhaps there will always be, something serious, obscure, profound, and unexplainable which escapes and troubles me and the whole story. I inevitably feel the need to cite my own work, something which I rarely do, not even in my classroom, but I'll do it only to better identify the path and direction of my quest. The Bible remains the so-called Urtext for all those interested and involved in Jewish learning and scholarship. It is hafochba de kulaba, which means turn and turn the pages, study the same passage again and again. We shall always discover in them something new, always exciting and enriching. I remember as a child I would learn in Cheder, in my school, when I was very young, I would learn of Sarah's difficulties to have children, and one day I rushed home to my mother and announced the great news, "Mother, Sarah is pregnant." Some more serious commentators believe that the Torah is not only a story or stories of the ancient past, but also a blueprint for the distant future. In other words, the Akedah, the binding of Isaac, is not only about Abraham and Isaac, but about their descendants as well. Isn't it a reason, or the reason, why we invoke their tale in our prayers on the high holidays? But before we continue our renewed explanation of this dramatic tale, I think we should follow our tradition and recall the guidelines that we have established for 32 years, since the very beginning of these annual encounters. One, each of these sessions is simply a quest, and I hope you know how grateful I am to all of you and to you, Provost Campbell, for being here. I am grateful for your participation. Just as the reader takes an active part in the book he or she is reading, the person who listens helps the speaker place a step or a thought, one before the other, one after the other. Two, my objective is to share with you a passion, mine, which is the passion for learning. In doing so, I wish to transform information into knowledge, knowledge into sensitivity, and sensitivity into commitment. Three, I never had an ambition to innovate commentaries or interpretations. All I want is to go deeper into them. Four, I firmly believe that the past is in the present. Whatever we do today contains elements that we have received from our parents and teachers and theirs. And with luck and patience, we could open hidden and not so hidden doors into our texts, into our lives. And then, of course, thank you, Professor Gilman, for your words. They bring consolation and comfort to someone who tries to give what he has received. And you, Professor Gilman, you bring knowledge, you bring grace and understanding, which honor our school. As to my students, I have a message. Tomorrow's class on Hasidism will begin not at 8 o'clock, but at 8:30. So you can sleep another half hour. But don't sleep here tonight. And now let's look again at the biblical text, shall we? Vayihachar hadvarim ha'ele. And it happened only after these events. In another place, Rashi, the great commentator, says that each time the term vayihi, and it was, or and it happened, each time it is used, it means a story to follow will be said. In this case, was he right? Is the story sad? So sad. So we understand the importance and meaning of this word, vayihi. But what about the meaning of the following words? Achar hadvarim ha'ele, after these events. But which events? We don't know. The last episodes preceding the passage first describe Hagar's expulsion and the miraculous survival of her son Ishmael in the wilderness, but also the alliance that Abraham made with the king Abimelech after a dispute over several wells. What is the relationship between these events? Is it some sort of illusion, of hint, to the fact that God is unhappy with his faithful servant and friend and chooses to put him to the test so as to punish him? It's possible. Is it possible that Abraham was wrong to expel from his home his son Ishmael and his mother Hagar, so despised by Sarah, instead of concluding an alliance with her family, or as he did with other kings? Oh, Abraham, of course, had a very good excuse. God told him. God told him something which bothers husbands to this day. God had told him, Abraham, you must listen to the voice of your wife. Speaking of the present time, but Rashi, forever full of imagination and thinking perhaps about Job, whom the Talmud frequently compares to Abraham, Rashi believes it is necessary now to introduce Satan into the narrative. Whenever we need real drama, we have Satan. Let's consult our favorite sources, the Midrash, and listen. And it came to pass, after these things that God tried Abraham. After what things? According to Rabbi Yochanan, in the name of Rabbi Yossi ben Zimra, after the things following the feast, the fiesta, given by the parents upon the child's having grown and being weaned, Satan spoke to the Holy One. Master of the universe, look, out of the entire feast that this old man, upon whom you have bestowed fruit of the womb at the age of 100, out of the entire feast which he gave to the whole company there, could he not have spared, say, one turtle dove, one fledgling, as an offering, not to his guests, but to you? And the Holy One replied, my dear Satan, is it not true that Abram prepared the feast in honor of his son, not mine? Still, if I say to him, Abram, sacrifice your son to me, I'm telling you, he will sacrifice him at once. Try him, said Satan. At once, God tested Abram. Really? That's how it began? In this context, then, Hadvarim Ha'ele, these things, would not mean events, but words. Really, Davar Dvarim, words. Exchanged between whom? God and Satan. No wonder that Job is often compared to Abraham. Because both were virtuous and exemplary? No. Because both were tested? No. They are compared because both tests were imagined, suggested, initiated, and willed by Satan. Strange the influence Satan has both on people and God. Strange and perplexed that he can have his way with me. That he can have his way with frail and vulnerable human beings is more than less normal. He has seduction, and we are weak. But how is one to explain his ability to induce God himself in making him do curious things initiated by someone whose name is synonymous with evil? Really, friends, is it conceivable? The Akedah, one of the most dramatic and meaningful episodes in Scripture, thus in Israel's religious history, was nothing but a banal wager in heaven? The Akedah, a game? And little else? In another version, Satan accuses Abraham of having given nothing to beggars, having not fed the needy. So, Abraham is indifferent to the care and suffering of the poor, our grandfather Abraham, whose surname is Chesed, is compassion. And God replies, in this version, listen, Abraham is neither stingy nor selfish. He would be willing to give me all what is dearest to him. He would give me his son if I were to ask. And I must admit that this account also disturbs me. Is it really possible that the entire episode was nothing but a manipulation, a trick by the old perverted actor named Satan? It seems that Rashi himself is unsatisfied with this sole hypothesis and suggests another. It is after the exchange between not God and Satan, but the verbal exchange between Ishmael and Isaac that the story is set into motion. What happened? Ishmael boasts before his brother, saying, look, Isaac, you were circumcised when you were 8 days old. Big deal. But I was 13 years old, and I didn't protest a bit. Isaac's response, you speak only of a tiny body part that you gave to God. I would be willing to give my entire being in sacrifice if God asked so. Thus it is how God came to put Abraham to the test. And this second explanation carries its own set of difficulties. It would mean that it is in fact Isaac who is put to test. And so he is the hero, not Abraham. Furthermore, isn't it conceivable that this grandiose account, is it conceivable, was just the result of a jealous spat between two brothers who didn't like each other? Let's continue reading the chapter. Ve'elokim nisa et Avraham, and God put Abraham to test. What? As with Job, didn't God know the outcome of the story? Was he, the omniscient, unaware it would stop halfway through incomplete? That the act would remain unaccomplished? Vayomer Elav, and God says to him, Avraham or Abraham, who answers, Hineni, here I am. And listen to the Midrashic dialogue. And God says, Kach et bincha, take thy son. And Abraham says, I have two sons. God said, Et yechidcha, your only son. And Abraham answers, both are only sons. Isaac is the only son I have from his mother. And Ishmael is the only son I have from his mother. And God says, Asher ahavta, the son whom you love. And Abraham answers, Master of the universe, are there two separate chambers in one's innermost self for love? I love both of them. And God says, Et Yitzchak, okay, I want Isaac by name. Question raised by the Midrash. Why did God engage Abraham in such a lengthy question and answer when he knew the outcome? And the answer is God knew, Abraham did not. Furthermore, God was worried that Abraham's mind could be stunned by such a heartbreaking demand. Abraham had to be prepared. And my commentary on this dialogue is a bit different. Simply, what we do is we change the punctuation of the words. It alludes to the question of sin and punishment, and here is my reading. God says, Kach et bincha, take my son, comma, et bicha, your only son, asher ahavta, without the comma in between, the only son you loved, Isaac. In other words, God blames Abraham for loving only one of his sons, Isaac, and this is why he is put to the test, maybe as a punishment. Is Abraham now surprised, shocked? Does he ask for a reason, saying, Mr. God, why are you doing it? Why? Why do I deserve it? Why do you deserve that? Does he ask for time to think about it? Let me think. To prepare, psychologically, mentally, spiritually. He could answer, Lord, why do you insist on testing the faith and fidelity of men, all men, through suffering rather than through happiness? He doesn't answer, but rises in the morning, while Sarah is asleep, and of course we know how this story unfolds. He is on the way, but we must stop here. A new question arises. Søren Kierkegaard has already asked the question. How did Abraham know it was the voice of God, God's voice, and not Satan's? Maimonides and Don Yitzchak Abravanel answer quite simply, that Abraham possessed prophetic gifts in varying degrees and thus could not be deceived. Kierkegaard takes for granted that the voice one hears is always the voice of God, that the only right response, therefore, is obedience. And Kierkegaard, I quote him, says, Abraham, to be sure, could not confuse with another the voice which once bade him leave his homeland. Lech lecha l'eretz Amoria. It can happen, however, that a sinful man is uncertain whether he does not have to sacrifice his son to God. For Moloch, who wants children as sacrifice, imitates the voice of God. Believe it or not, Jean-Paul Sartre, a French existentialist philosopher who didn't stop speaking about God, although he was an atheist, or maybe because he was an atheist, he never stopped speaking about God. And he echoes Kierkegaard's anguish, which in fact reflects a Midrashic sage. Sartre wonders, if an angel were to appear before me, where is the proof that it is an angel? And if I hear voices, who will persuade me that they come from heaven and not from hell, from my subconscious, or from a pathological state of mind, rather than from a holy source? In the Midrash, Abraham knew it, since he realized that the role of Satan here is precisely to keep him from fulfilling the divine will. Besides, it's because of Satan that the journey took 3 days in spite of the short distance. It's a very short distance. A master of magic, expert in roadblocks and obstacles, Satan made sure there were many along the way. And this beautiful story from the 12th and 13th centuries is cited by Rabbi Eliezer of Worms in the Midrash Tanchuma and the chapters of Rabbi Eliezer. It let us read and listen to the Midrash. I quote, "As Abram journeyed towards Moriah, an old man appeared before him. It was Satan in disguise. And he asked, 'Where are you going?' 'To prayer,' said Abram. 'With a knife,' said Satan. 'With a firestone and wood? Nobody goes to prayer like that.' 'Well,' Abram explained, 'we may be delayed a day or two. We then would have to slaughter a lamb, place it on a fire, to feed ourselves. It's best to be prepared.' Thereupon Satan dropped his mask and said, 'Poor old man with your poor old tales. Do you think you can fool me? Don't you know I was present when the order was given?' Abram did not reply. Satan continued shouting, 'Tell me, old man, have you lost your mind? Have you emptied your heart of all human feeling? Will you really sacrifice your son given to you at the age of 100? "Yes," said Abram, "I shall." "But tomorrow, old fool," said Satan, "he will demand more sacrifices, more cruel yet. Will you be able to perform them too?" "I hope so," replied Abram. "I hope to always be able to obey God. But tomorrow, poor mortal, he may accuse you of murder. He who gave the order will accuse you of murder. He will condemn you for having obeyed. Will you do it nevertheless?" "Yes, I shall," Abram insisted. "I shall do it anyway. I must obey him. That is my desire. That's my life." Having failed with the father, Satan tried his luck with the son. He appeared before him disguised as a young boy. "Where are you going?" "To study Torah," answered Isaac. "Now or after your death?" asked Abram. "What a foolish question," said Isaac. "Of course now. Don't you know that Torah is given only to the living?" "Poor son of a poor woman," said Satan. "For years and years she lived in hope and prayer to give birth to you. And now this old man, your own father, had gone mad. Look at him. He's going to kill you." Isaac would not believe him. Instead, he looked at his father with love. So Satan went on feigning compassion. "Yes, you are about to die, believe me. And you know who will rejoice? Your brother Ishmael. He will be happy. Your clothes, your possessions, the gift meant for you, he will get them all." And this argument, so childish, so human, gave Isaac pause. He turned to his father and shyly asked him, "Look at this person, father, listen to what he says." "Don't pay any attention, son," said Abraham. "His words are empty of meaning and truth. Do not listen." Still, the story does not end here. Satan refused to concede defeat. He invented other obstacles. He turned himself into a river. Abram chased the waves away. He then changed himself into a cloud, only to be dispersed by Abram. Finally, Satan had a brilliant idea. He would use the most dangerous weapon of all, truth. And he decided to gamble, to reveal the facts, and declared, "Abram, this is what I heard, Miachorei HaPargot. This is what I heard backstage up there. Ultimately, the lamb will be the offering, not Isaac. Do you hear me, old man? You have nothing to fear, neither does Isaac. Whether you continue or turn back, it's all the same. It's nothing but a game, a simple test. So stop tormenting yourself. Don't take yourself for a hero." Had Abraham believed Satan, who was after all telling the truth, the drama would have ended then and there. Instead, he ignored Satan and proceeded with his now silent march toward that precise point where despair and fate were to meet in a fiery and senseless quest. Don Yitzchak Abravanel is one of my favorite medieval thinkers. I like the depth of his vision and his penetrating insights. A man of great erudition and culture, he was admired by the Jews and respected by the Gentiles. He held an important position in the royal court, not at all easy during the reign of the Catholic king and the queen, Ferdinand and Isabella. He must have been good, extremely gifted in his work. Yet in 1492, under the Grand Inquisitor Thomas de Torquemada, he was forced, like all Jews, to choose between conversion and exile, and he chose exile, leaving behind fame and fortune. Another influential and intelligent Jew, also a rabbi, held a high position in court at the same time as him, Don Abraham Sr. He also faced the same choice, and he chose conversion. And he disappeared from Jewish history, while Don Yitzchak Abravanel has remained for centuries and even today as a source of melancholy, pride, and joy for teachers and students alike. I especially admired his literary sensitivity to this chapter and his analysis of the event on Mount Moriah. He quotes Rabbi Yonah ibn Janah, who offers quite an interesting grammatical interpretation of the text. God commands Abraham to bring his son as an offering. And the term is le'olah, which could also signify the opposite of its usual meaning, not as an offering, but in the place of an offering. In other words, the first acceptance will serve as a substitute for the act. The walk on Mount Moriah will already count as a sacrifice. For God did not want him as a sacrifice. He simply to come, and the coming would be the sacrifice. The text continues. On the third day, Abraham lifted his eyes and saw. Why on the third day? Asked the Midrash. Why not on the first or the second? And the answer is so that nations of the world would not say God deranged Abraham's spirit. And so he caught his son's throat in a fit of insanity. Today, everybody pleads mental disease. Question. Why should the nations of the world, their leaders and their populations care about one Jew does or doesn't do far away? Perhaps the Midrash wanted us to be aware of the Jew's place in the world. It's out of all proportions to its size. There is something quasi-metaphysical in Jewish history. Look in today's newspapers. Events in or around Jerusalem get more attention than those taking place in Moscow or Beijing. So on the third day, Abram lifted his eyes and saw the place from afar. In the biblical text, the father was alone to see it. In the Midrash, he turned to his son and asked him, "Do you see what I see?" Isaac replied, "I see a mountain radiant in majesty with a mysterious cloud hovering over it." Abram asked his servants the same question, but they saw nothing but wilderness. So Abram understood what he was supposed to do. He told his servants to stay behind with the donkey while, I quote, I and the lad go over there to kneel down, and we will come back to you. Nashuva elechem. In the verb is important. Remember it well. It's in the plural. We shall return. After the test was done, the story finished, we shall return to you. And then at the end of the story, the text does something strange. It says, Vayashav Avraham el Ne'arav. And Abraham returned to his servants. And this verse is one of the most enigmatic and difficult verses in the narrative. Vayashav is in the singular. And he returned in the singular. And where was Isaac? What became of the other main character of the Akedah? Oh, several answers exist and all indicate that there was a rupture, if not a separation between father and son. Rabbi Yosef Bar Chanina thinks that his father sent him back home to protect him from the evil eye. Others believe that he stayed on site at Mount Moriah alone for 3 years before coming back to marry Rebecca. This is why his young bride, Rebecca, fainted and fell from the camel upon seeing him. He looked too sick. He didn't look like he came from this world. He came from another world. So she fainted. Another theory is that he was led away to paradise where he was treated for his depression during 3 years. Some believe that sick and traumatized from what he had just undergone, he stayed behind simply to rest. Or perhaps that he went to study at the famous school of Shechem, of shame. Or even that he had died There is a source that says that actually he died, that the intervention of the angel came too late, that Abraham's dagger or knife had already scored the throat of Isaac, whose soul had left the body. Some sources and litanies speak of the blood of Isaac. Some others, one that we read during Rosh Hashanah, speak about the ash of Isaac, which means he had died on the altar. He was already burned on the altar. But then, what do you do then with Isaac then in history? So some commentators said that he was resurrected immediately, miraculously, and then he recited the right prayer. Praised be thou, Lord of the universe, for resurrecting the dead. And one last story simply is that he didn't accompany his father, who went no one knows where. One text says he went to Mary, Ketora. But Isaac went home, says this version. Again, it is Abrabanel, my favorite Abrabanel, who says it. And I must admit again to have succumbed to the elegant charm of his interpretation. He quotes, the Bible says that Abram came to bury Sarah and mourn her. And Isaac, didn't he come to his mother's funeral? No, says Abrabanel, he did not come because he was already there. When the event occurs, a man goes back to his mother. So the Akedah story, which reverberates so deeply in the Midrashic realm, strangely had a profound impact on Jewish communities during the Crusades. At that time, filled with fury and malediction, countless men and women, all pious and God-loving, in fear of being violated, tormented, mutilated, and eventually converted by faith-demented armed mobs, chose collective suicide as a way of demonstrating their loyalty to the God of Israel. All seemed to have been influenced by the Akedah, imitating both Abraham and Isaac, dying for the sanctification of God's name. To understand that quasi-mystical connection, one must read Jewish books on martyrology. There are three of them. Extraordinary works of literature and history. Emeka Bachao, The Valley of Lamentation, Shevet Yehudah, Yaveh Metzula, scenes of relentless, unbearable cruelty fill their pages. You read them and you wonder and weep. We may speak about it, and we speak about the Jewishness of Jesus, about the Crusades. You read the Catholic Encyclopedia, and you read the Jewish Encyclopedia. It's not the same story of the Crusades. For them it was a period of glory, and for us a period of torment. And you read them and you wonder and weep, how could people, invoking their love for their God of love, commit such atrocities? I hesitate to quote any of them, lest we are all robbed of sleep for nights to come. But you must also reread the late Shalom Spiegel's masterfully written volume called The Last Trial on the Akedah and its impact on that period in Jewish and Christian history. Anyone who wrote anything on that dramatic event owes him a lasting debt of gratitude. 18 liturgical poems of Piyutim were written about what happened then in the Rhine provinces. A 12th century sage, Rabbi Ephraim of Bonn, quoted by Spiegel, who calls it a work on the slaughter of Isaac and his resurrection. And listen. Dawn upon him, Isaac, fell the resurrected dew, and he revived. The father seized him then to slaughter once more. Torah, bear witness. Well grounded is the fact. And the Lord called Abraham even a second time from heaven. The ministering angels cried out, terrified. Even animal victims, were they ever slaughtered twice? And instantly they made their outcry hard on high. Lo, Ariel's angels cried out above the earth. Why twice? Because the angel addressed Abraham a second time? Or is it because the Akedah moved from Mount Moriah to the Rhine provinces? Rabbi Kalonimus Bar Yehuda laments, fathers slaughter their sons and wallow in their blood. Rejoicing, they make haste to affirm God's unique name. Father and sons together, grooms with their brides, hurry to their slaughter as to their bridal chamber. And Rabbi David Bar Meshulam weeps. Has it ever been heard or ever be seen? Who can believe so amazing a thing? As to the beautiful bridal canopy, sons are led to the slaughter, most highly exalted. When such things happen, how can you hold your peace? In these laments, one finds echoes of Midrashic legends, in faithful conscious choice of death, faced with the ultimate agony of apostasy. Let's know that the events of self-sacrifice and collective suicide so as to avoid conversion are to be found in the Rhine provinces of Ashkenaz, but not in Sephardic history. Is it that forced conversion to Islam was judged less severely than conversion under duress to Christianity? The late Gershon Cohen wrote a remarkable essay on the subject. We may return to it another time. But what remains as a fact is that the Akedah impacted two communities in different ways. To better understand the dramatic meaning of the Akedah, it is necessary to go to the Rembrandt Museum in Amsterdam. There one can see to what degree the great artist, whom I love, was fascinated by this story. Harav Kook, the old Harav Kook in Israel, wrote that in Rembrandt, he found, quote, the original and secret light, the Ora Kadmon, the hidden light, the Ora Ganus, which crosses the world from one end to the other. Numerous sketches show the anguish engulfing Abraham, dagger in hand, leaning over his terrified son, motionless on the altar. Unflinching, the old father's face shows his painful determination to carry his task out to the end. But the completed painting shows a different picture. Rembrandt changed this outlook, and the picture shows the knife on the ground while father and son embrace. In this moment one realizes this time death did not win. Man, the Jewish man, has won against God, or rather with God. Because after all, we must repeat and say it. The Akedah is not just in the past, but also in the present. And all we need to do is look at what is happening today in this torn, blood-soaked world, riddled with almost apocalyptic convulsions. And we wonder, what is happening to this crazy world? And where is God in all this? What is He doing where His creation is losing its compass, its sanity? And where is Satan? That we know. Satan, where we know he is, but God. We still ponder this question looking back on the century which has just left us. Where was he when the descendants of Abraham were subjected to the torments of the Akedah day after day, night after night, under a sky on fire? Well, contrary to what happened on Mount Moriah, it was the son who left his father behind and came back alone, his heart heavy with grief, despair, and remorse. The Akedah in reverse. And we ask the question and then ask it again and again, and what about God? Where was he when death took his place and his role in digging the invisible cemeteries in the heart of humanity? Before such questions, we throw so many certainties into question. We cry in silence. Is it God's fault? Are we his orphans or his victims? Must we, can we shed tears over creation and its creator or for him? Are we here to feel pathos, to feel sympathy, to feel compassion for God, what we have done with his universe? And Isaac in all this. Talmudic commentaries talk a lot about Abraham's situation, but little, truly too little about Isaac's. And yet the story is called Akedat Yitzchak, the binding of Isaac. Wasn't it his test too? What were his thoughts during his ordeal? What did he feel when he opened his eyes on the altar, seeing his father with a knife in his hands? Midrashic sources depict him as a consenting victim, if not enthusiastic associate and participant. One Midrash says, while Abraham was building the altar, Isaac kept handing him the wood and the stones. Abraham was like a man, says the Midrash, who builds the wedding house for his son, and Isaac was like a man getting ready for the wedding feast, which he does with joy. At one point, When already stretched on the altar, he tells his father, "Please, Father, tie me tighter to the altar so I do not move inadvertently and make the knife impure by hitting it." Which means that he, Isaac, age 13 or 37, according to different sources, was ready and willing to die because of an order given to God by his father. Why didn't he protest? Why didn't he say, if God wants my life, okay, I'll give it to him. But he could at least be polite enough to tell me about it. On the other hand, is it possible that he had such love for and such faith in his father that until the last moment he was convinced that the story would not end in death? After all, he also heard his father tell the two servants that we shall return. Could a son think of his father that the father was a liar? And what about compassion and pity in all this? It seemed that the God of justice and Abram, the man of kindness, have conspired against Isaac with no one feeling sorry for him. Well, the angels did. They, like Satan, did try to prevent the trial for good reasons. And they pleaded with God to stop it. They wept, the Midrash tells us, and their tears fell into Isaac's open eyes. That's why, later on, he became blind. But their intercession was in vain. Angels don't rule the heavens. Actually, much has been said and much is still said about the anguish of Abraham in having to choose between two loves, the one he experienced for his son and the other which he kept for his creator, between religious faith and human morality, between fidelity to what which transcends and compassion for what which is eminent. Did Abraham ever doubt the origin of the voice that gave the order? Did a dark thought ever cross his mind that his voice was perhaps really not coming from God? Let's take a step back for a look. Earlier we had read the Midrash, which emphasizes the moment where Abraham is overwhelmed by the deepest of anguish. This is the moment when, because of Satan's trick, he and his son think they are going to drown. His brow wrinkled with worry, the desperate, distressed father cries out to the world and to the stars, "If death wins now, what will become of the mission conferred on me by God himself?" That what moved Abraham to astonishment, to doubt, to despair. And here we find the grandeur of Abraham. In the dismal moment, the most serious of his manhood, it is neither about himself nor his close ones that he thinks. He thinks about God, about his name, his glory, about his suffering, about the mission that God had given him. Thus the test was a double-edged test. God subjected Abraham to it, yet at the same time Abraham forced it on God. As though Abraham had said, "I defy you, Lord, I shall submit to your will, but let us see whether you shall go to the end, whether you shall remain passive and remain silent when the life of my son, who is also your son, is at stake." And God conveniently, gracefully changed his mind and relented. Abraham won. That was why God sent an angel to revoke the order and congratulate him, because he himself, God, was embarrassed. And suddenly we have another, what we call in France, a coup de théâtre, a dramatic turn. Abraham never ceases to astonish us. Having won the round, he became demanding. Since God had given in, Abraham was not going to be satisfied with one victory and continue the relationship as though nothing had changed. His turn had come to dictate conditions to God, upon God, or else he would pick up his knife and come what may. Let's listen to the Midrash. When Abraham heard the angel's voice, he did not cry out with joy or express gratitude. On the contrary, he began to argue. He who until now had obeyed with sealed lips suddenly showed inordinate skepticism. He did question the counter-order he had been hoping for. First he asked that the angel identify himself in due form. Then he demanded proof that he was really God's messenger, not Satan's. And finally, he simply refused to accept the message, saying, "God himself ordered me to sacrifice my son. It's up to him to rescind that order. If not, I go on." And says the Midrash, God again had to give in And he personally said to Abraham not to harm his son. And this is Abraham's second victory. And yet he wasn't satisfied. Listen, when Abraham heard the celestial voice ordering him to spare his son Isaac, he declared, "I swear I shall not leave the altar, Lord, before I speak my mind." "Speak," said God. "Did you not promise me that my descendants would be as numerous as the stars in the sky?" "Yes, I did promise you that." "And whose descendants will they be? Mine? Mine alone?" "No," said God. "They will be Isaac's as well." "And didn't you also promise me that they will inherit the earth?" "Yes," said God. "I promise you that too." "And whose descendants will they be? Mine alone?" "No," said God's voice. "They will be Isaac's as well." "Well then, my Lord," said Abraham unabashedly, "I could have pointed out to you before that your order contradicted your promise. I could have spoken up. I didn't. I contained my grief and held my tongue. In return, I want you to make me the following promise, that when in the future my children and my children's children throughout the generations will act against your law and against your will, you will not be angry. You will also say nothing. You will forgive them. If not, so be it," God agreed. "Let them retell this tale, and they will be forgiven." But unlike God, Satan hates to lose. Unlike God, he takes revenge. Defeated by Abraham and Isaac, he turned against Sarah, appearing before her disguised as Isaac. And he told her the true story that was taking place just then on Mount Moriah. He told her of the march, the ritual ceremony. "At this moment," he said, "your husband is about to slaughter your son." Sarah was on the roof of a house, and barely had Satan finished talking that Sarah fell to the ground, dead. But the story does not end there. Isaac survived. He had no choice. He had to make something of his memories, his experience, in order to force us to hope. For our survival is linked to his. Satan could kill Sarah. He could even hurt Abraham. But Isaac was beyond his reach. Isaac, too, represents defiance. Abraham defied God. Isaac defied death. What did happen to Isaac after he left Mount Moriah? He became a poet. He became the author of the Mincha service, the afternoon service. He did not break with society, nor did he rebel against life. Logically, he should have aspired to wandering, to the pursuit of oblivion. After all, to go through such an ordeal, such a trauma. Instead, he settled on his land, never to leave it again, retaining his name. He married, had children. Refusing to let fate turn him into a bitter man, he felt neither hatred nor anger towards his contemporaries who did not share his experience. On the contrary, he liked them and showed concern for their well-being. After Moriah, he devoted his life and his right to immortality to the defense of his people. It will be Isaac's privilege to remain Israel's Melitz Yosher, the defender of his people, pleading his cause with great ability. He will be entitled to say anything he likes to God, ask anything of him. Because he suffered? No, we know that. In the Jewish tradition, suffering confers no privileges. It all depends on what one makes of that suffering. Isaac knew how to transform it into prayer and love, rather than into anger and malediction. This is what gives him rights and powers no other man possesses. His reward, the temple was built not on Sinai, but on Moriah. In conclusion, is this the end of the Akedah, with Sarah the only victim, to teach us that no one may engage in theological confrontations with impunity? God and Abraham engaged in a test and Sarah died. Says the Midrash, it was Satan's fault. So what? But why did Sarah listen to Satan? Satan spoke, and Sarah could have said, "I don't believe you." Sarah is the only character in the story who died of the consequence of the Akedah, the only person who died in an accident. Why? I have looked for an answer in Midrashic sources without real success. She wasn't involved in the event. Why then? for she singled out to pay for it with her life. And the only possible hypothesis that I have is that maybe she died in order to atone for the sin of sending Ishmael away into the wilderness, thus exposing him and his mother to danger and death. Is that why Isaac lost his mother and Abraham his wife? Was therefore the Akedah, the binding of Isaac, the chapter, the story, a tale of correcting an injustice? And so we come anyway to the end of the drama. Actually, on the surface, most of the participants ought to feel good about its outcome. Isaac for remaining alive, Abraham for still being a father, and God for being reassured of his friend's loyalty. Nonetheless, God never spoke to Abraham again. And Satan? What about him? Is he the loser? Don't worry about him. He never gives up. You'll find him in literature. But Abraham, did Abraham ever ask Isaac to forgive him? Did he at least explain to him what happened? Did father and son speak to one another again? We don't know. The text doesn't say it, and I think probably not. The text would have mentioned it. The term yachdav, together, is no longer operative here. No doubt they are no longer together. But they are, of course, they remain together in our prayers, in our wonder, in our memory. We remember their anguish, we remember the altar and the fire. But I cannot leave the story with somehow giving the image of Abraham who has done something terribly wrong. In conclusion, I would say I believe that Abraham had faith, and his faith remained unshaken. He had faith in God so much that he was convinced from the beginning God will not ask him to sacrifice his son. That is Abraham's faith. His faith is not that he said, okay, I will do it. His real faith was, he said, what? God wants me to do it? Oh, no. It's only a test. Thank you.
You've just heard the first of three lectures in the annual series, The Fascination with Jewish Tales, by teacher, author, and Nobel Peace Prize winner Elie Wiesel. Tonight's lecture was titled, In the Bible, the Akedah Revisited, More Questions. Introducing Professor Wiesel was Boston University Professor Abigail Gilman from the Department of Modern Languages and Comparative Literature in the College of Arts and Sciences. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Jared Mooney with help from Matt Sloan. Our web producer is Angel Cazelli. The executive producer for Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydotis. I'm Deborah Becker. Thanks for joining us.